Thank you, Terry. This is very much short notice, I think, and I must apologize for any ragged ends there are in my presentation. But I look out at your eager and intelligent looking faces, and I gather, from what Terry tells me, that you're all in physics or allied fields, very much interested in how to apply the physical sciences to biological problems. And so what I'll try to do is I talk a little bit about many, many different aspects of evolutionary biology. I'll try always to remember that you're interested in that. And I'm sure as the 24 hours or so that I'm here wear on, I'll meet quite a few of you and learn your names and what you do. But at the moment, at least, it might make sense since we're here and we might as well spend the afternoon talking about a lot of really quite interesting things. My bona fides for doing this kind of thing are that I am an evolutionary biologist and have been for the last 40 or so years. And among other things, I've dealt with evolutionary biology in fruit flies, in yeasts, in bacteria, a number of other organisms. I've been very much interested in the origin of the human species and have done some work looking at mitochondrial DNAs and the famous question of the mitochondrial Eve that you've probably heard about at one time or other. And we'll talk a little bit about that, I think, as we go along. I've written a number of popular books on the subject, none of which you've read probably, but nonetheless, there they are. And dealing with a variety of different evolutionary topics, human evolution, the evolution of evolvability, that is to say, you know, is it possible that genes can actually get better at evolving? And these are all questions that I don't think we'll get to today, but nonetheless, these are things that we'll probably touch on as we proceed. And most recently, I've been involved in writing a textbook, an upper division, that is to say, a late undergraduate or upper undergraduate textbook on evolution for Freeman and Company. Freeman are the people who, of course, do Scientific American books and so on, and so they're, so far at least, they seem to be doing a terrific job making lovely, colorful pictures out of the pictures that I give to them. I'll be showing you some of these things as we go along. Terry said that sometimes the people who give talks put these things on the web. I'm embarrassed, I really can't do that, because since I'm in the middle of writing the book, I think perhaps the publisher would not be pleased if I let this stuff out onto the web, unless there was some security associated with it, which I presume there isn't. So do pay attention then when I show these pictures, because this is going to be the last time you see them, until the book comes out. So you'll be getting an early glimpse, at least, of my own rather inept draftsmanship and pasting of things together. The book will look much more professional, I'm sure, than the early versions of pictures. Okay. So as I gather from what Terry tells me, you've had a lecture or two about the basics of molecular biology, just to get everybody up to speed on that, so we can all realize the central dogma, DNA, has the information, it passes the information to RNA, RNA picks up the transcribed information from DNA, and this information is then translated into protein, and we're all pretty confident that most of the time, at least, that's the way the flow goes. Sometimes, of course, you have a little bit of an end run. Sometimes RNA is copied back to DNA, and that kind of thing can happen with some viruses. It seems to be happening in our own cells occasionally, but for the most part, the flow is from DNA to proteins, and so you've learned about that. The advent of molecular biology, which really, I suppose, can be dated to 1953, and the discovery of the structure of DNA by Watson and Crick. The advent of molecular biology really, for the first time, put evolutionary biology on a firm basis where we can really begin to see what's actually happening to the genes. Up to that point, evolutionary biologists had really been working in the dark to some degree. For example, there was no indication, though things gradually, I think, were evidence was gradually accumulating, but there was no indication until the understanding of the structure of DNA and of the genetic code, no indication that all organisms on the earth had a common ancestor. It was, you know, people suspected that they did, but it wasn't certain. Bacteria were so different from creatures like us. It doesn't, you know, people assumed, Charles Darwin assumed that all organisms could be traced back to a common ancestor, but they weren't sure about that. It wasn't, as I say, until the advent of molecular biology, the breaking of the genetic code, and the realization that every living organism we know of, and all the viruses that afflict them, all have the same genetic code. When that was discovered, everything clicked into place, of course, and it was, I suppose, the first great discovery that the molecular biologists presented to the evolutionists, to say that Darwin was right in his hunch that all living organisms could be traced back to a single origin. And that, of course, was terrific, because it really made things much more exciting, because we now know that the processes that happened to us, the evolutionary processes that have shaped us, are really no different from the evolutionary processes that have shaped bacteria and viruses. The same things happen to us as to bacteria and viruses and redwood trees and whales and any number of other organisms you can think of. These things really are essentially universal throughout the living world. Further, we can begin to build a kind of tree of life which we never could before. And I've got a little picture here of this tree of life. Which will give you some idea of the kinds of things we're talking about. Now, I hope people can see this. Yep. Here we go. Can people make that out? If not, I'm going to point out various features of this tree. This is a tree that's the result of many different people's work, starting with Carl Woese, who was the first to begin to sequence pieces of the genes. Well, actually, he started with pieces of RNA that he got from various bacteria and sequenced them to find what the sequence of bases was in the RNA. Everyone remembers about bases, right? The sequence of bases in the nucleic acids will tell you a lot about the nature of the code, of the coded information that's on that nucleic acid. So, starting with that information, and later on beginning to put together these sequences into a tree of relationships, Woese and the people who followed him began to realize that this tree, which had this common origin, which you can see here, sort of in this general region here, nobody knows exactly where it is, but it's probably somewhere in there, a common origin from which all the living organisms on the planet essentially have radiated, descended, in the process, of course, of something on the order of 3.8 billion years, that period of time during which living organisms have existed on the planet. Now, we can't really go back as far as 3.8 billion years, because there's some evidence that there was a fair amount of evolution that has sort of disappeared from this tree. But the branching that you see here, this trifurcation of this tree, going off into three great branches, probably happened something on the order of 3.2 billion years ago. And before that time, we have some evidence that a lot of evolution was happening before that time, but we know that there are some organisms that for sure have to go back before then, but we don't have a good indication of exactly what happened to those organisms and what kind of organisms they were. But you can see that this tree, which has been arranged as a kind it's as if you were looking down on the tree from the top. So the root of the tree is here, the trunk of the tree, if you like, is here, and all the branches are going out in different directions. Normally you'll see, they see all kinds of evolutionary trees. You may see a tree where you start over at the left and everything sort of goes to the right, so that time goes in this direction, right? That's the kind of tree you've probably seen at one time or other. This tree, however, is a little different because time is going in this direction and this direction and this direction. These organisms are all radiating out, if you like, from the root of the tree. What Woese and his colleague found was that you could group organisms into three gigantic groups. The eubacteria, the true bacteria, which you see up in this branch here, the archaea, which you see over here, And these are bacteria-like organisms. Here's a pair, I don't know if you can see this very well. Here's a picture of an archaea. It happens to be one that has been labeled with a fluorescent compound so that you can see it. It's something called sulfolobus, and it grows essentially on pure sulfur. The archaea, like the bacteria, are extremely biochemically diverse organisms. They're very good at living in places that we couldn't begin to live in. And both the bacteria and the archaea exhibit an enormous range of different biochemistries, far wider than the biochemistries we see among the organisms we're more familiar with, far more diverse than the biochemistries that we see when we look at humans and plants or something like that. Their biochemistries are incredibly diverse. They can live on a wide variety of different substrates. They can get their energy from a wide variety of different energy-rich compounds. They really are biochemically diverse, and yet, morphologically, they're not terribly diverse. Both the eubacteria and the archaea, numerous as they are, they're everywhere in the living world. These organisms are all very simple. They're small, they can be round, they can be elongated, they can come in chains, they can come in little wiggly sort of shapes, like the spirochetes that cause syphilis and that come in many different other varieties. For example, embarrassing that we all have spirochetes living in our mouths, for example. So we're loaded with little wiggly bacteria that are, in fact, come in a great variety of different types, several of which happen to cause syphilis-like diseases. Okay, so all these different organisms that do all these different things, even though they all look very similar to each other, you can look at a little round bacterium, and it's very hard to tell it from another little round bacterium. But in fact, those two little round bacteria may be separated by an enormous amount of evolution. So you've got organisms then that are very similar in their appearance, but nonetheless can be very, very different in their biochemistries and in their genes. So you're looking, as you look at these very similar looking organisms, you're looking at a huge amount of biochemical evolution, a huge amount of biochemical diversity. Within these two great groups of organisms. The third group, the eukaryotes, include ourselves. And it's quite amusing that in this tree, the organisms that we're most familiar with, the ones that we see around us in the living world, are organisms that occupy this little teeny-weeny part of the tree here. You've got animals, you've got fungi here, you've got plants of various kinds here, higher plants here, you have algae popping off there, you've got various algae at various points in the tree and so on. You have lower eukaryotes such as the ciliates, the paramecium and other organisms that essentially are little microscopic single-celled organisms. And then a whole bunch of other rather interesting creatures like slime molds, as you see down here, that you rarely see, you've probably never encountered a slime mold, but they are surprisingly common. In woodlands, you'll find slime molds living under bark on dead trees and all sorts of places like that. So you can also go further and further down to a little creature like Giardia here, which is an organism that is essentially now completely a parasite. It lives in people's intestines. If you're unlucky, you've probably had a Giardia infection and it causes severe diarrhea. You can wipe it out with various drugs, but it can be pretty nasty. So Giardia is an organism that you'd think would be highly evolved because it is parasitic, it's living inside our own guts. It doesn't seem to be found anywhere else. Nonetheless, it's an organism, the ancestry of which has been around for a long time. Giardia has a long, long ancestry, long before there were any humans to prey on. What were the ancestors of Giardia doing all this time? We really don't know. We really have no idea. Waiting around for the intestine on which they could prey. So, we've got then an amazing variety of different creatures here, and as I say, the ones that we're most familiar with are right out in this tip part of the tree. This tree was built, as I said, from sequences of the genes that are responsible for some of the RNA molecules that are very important in our evolution. And those RNA molecules, it turns out, the ribosomal RNA molecules, which were the ones that that were put together for this tree, are molecules that evolve quite slowly. So it's possible to trace this tree out. An RNA molecule from a human is not impossibly different from an RNA molecule from one of these archaea over here. They're still related enough to each other that you can fit them in a tree. And of course, you need genes like that if you're going to look, as we are doing here, at the whole span of the living world on the planet at the present time. It doesn't do any good to look at quickly evolving genes, because by the time you get from here to here, there's no information left. They've undergone so much evolution that they are essentially not. They don't resemble each other in the slightest. But in the case of these slowly evolving genes, it's possible to retain enough information that you can essentially see how all of life, and this diagram in its own rather inadequate fashion, does represent all of the living organisms that we know of, at least the major groups that we know of. And there are probably going to be some others that have yet to be put in here. We might even find a fourth branch at some point, perhaps. But nonetheless, we've got a pretty good idea now of how pretty well everything is related to everything else. Really quite a remarkable feat, a combination of evolutionary biology and molecular biology. Everyone's with me on this. Am I being too simple-minded here? What's the deal? Yes? Sure.
So, can you point to any sort of simple characteristics of the genes between the bacteria and archaea?
Well, the simple characteristics that distinguish them are, again, their biochemistry. The eubacteria occupy a large number of different ecological niches. The archaea occupy rather different ones. You find, for example, methanogenic bacteria up here in this branch of the archaea. These are organisms that produce gaseous methane, okay? Methanogenic organisms are enormously active in the living world. They have, for example, been responsible for generating the large quantities of methane that one finds on trapped in the ocean floor. So methanogens are tremendously important parts of the living world. Some of the eubacteria can use the methane that the methanogens generate. So you have that kind of situation happen. The crinarchaeota here are organisms that often live at very high temperatures, and they may use sulfur compounds as energy sources. Some of the eubacteria can do the same thing, it turns out, but the crinarchaeota do it in a rather different way. So without going into a lot of the biochemical details, these organisms really are not only different in their gene sequence from these organisms, they're also different in their biochemistry. Yeah? The scale actually turns out to be the numbers of so-called base substitutions that happen down these various branches, okay? So the longer the branch, the more differences have accumulated between two sequences that you're looking at on the tree. The scale is reliable in the sense that if you do the appropriate manipulations before you build the tree, that is to say, you have to account in some fashion for multiple substitutions which you might miss. Because obviously, if sequences begin to diverge, if you just have two sequences, you might miss several substitutions that happened in between, and you can essentially make corrections using Omoto Kimura has come up with the most popular of these corrections, which essentially assumes that transitions and transversions happen at different rates, and you can then work out what the length of the branches may happen to be. It's interesting that you look here at, you know, animals, plants, and so on, all squeezed into this little area, and this big, big, long branch here. We know that animals and plants had a common ancestor well over a billion years ago. So you'd think then that that branch would go back about a third of the way to the origin. But it doesn't. Okay? And it rather looks as if evolution went much faster in the old days. At least this is the way I think pretty well everybody is thinking about the tree, that you've got a lot of very rapid evolution that happened with most organisms, and then it slowed down as it got out towards the tips of the tree. However, some organisms left behind. Aquifex, which is over here, you can't read that, nor can I. But anyway, it's an organism called Aquifex, a simple bacterium. Equifax is an organism that seems not to have done much evolving since the beginning of this radiation. So the amount, the rates at which these different organisms evolve do differ dramatically. And that, of course, is something which makes building a tree a little bit tough. Because if you've got branches that are very unequal in length, there are various statistical problems that happen with that, because a long branch sort of tends to attract other branches to it, and you then end up maybe with a rather distorted tree. There's too much weight put on a long branch compared with the short one. Leaving these statistical problems behind, however, leaving them aside, it really looks as if evolution has slowed down as you get out towards the tips. There was an awful lot of evolution happening back here, happening very fast. And then we seem to have pooped out a bit, and things seem to have slowed down somewhat. Yeah?
What do you look at in the sequence to determine what comes later?
Well, you need, of course, more than two sequences to do this, okay? Once you've got several sequences, you can then begin to build a tree using a variety of techniques. One commonly employed technique, which I think as a physicist you're familiar with, is a technique which is sort of like the traveling salesman problem, where you look at, you're blinking as if the blank, okay?
No, I didn't tell you.
Right, but what you're asking essentially is, if you've got a set of sequences, what's the minimum number of steps that it'll take you to get from one of these sequences to another? That is to say, can you build a tree from these sequences which has maximum parsimony, which has the most parsimonious number of steps between the sequences? And that can be done on the basis of looking at the bases that occupy different sites of the tree and asking, how can you get from one to another? I don't know if I can go into more details at this point. I don't know whether really that makes sense. In other words, how do you get back to the root? Is that what you're asking? Or if you don't root the tree, that is to say, if you say, you know, we're just looking at all these things and we're putting them together into the, let's say, the most parsimonious tree, or in this case, actually the algorithm that was used to build this tree is a so-called neighbor joining algorithm, in which you look not at the numbers, not at the types of base changes that have happened, but at the percent differences between sequences, and look in there and find the most the shortest tree given those percentages. Once you've done that, you'll end up with a tree like this. You're quite right, both of you are exactly right, but in fact I should have made plain at the beginning, is that the tips of this tree are what we've all that we've got. We have to infer what happened as we move back. You know, honey-shaped branches, which I think are mostly an artifact, but the tree should be much bushier than this, really. And it was mostly an artifact of the way the tree was built that made it look this funny. The tree should be bushier than this, and if we build a tree using these sequences that are out on the tips, we're going to get a place where everything comes together, and we suspect that that's probably where life began. Now, we don't know that, okay? We're going to root this tree on the basis of our assumption that life had a common origin. If you found two separate trees, where one group of organisms had absolutely nothing to do with another group of organisms, then you wouldn't be able to say anything about this root. But in fact, every one of these present-day sequences is related significantly to every other one of the present-day sequences, which is why we can put them together in this way. Does that help at all? Okay, terrific, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, if you have a new species, you've just sequenced its RNA and you'd like to know where it is on the tree. Oh, well, easy. You just simply, you could go to all the trouble of taking all the other sequences and fitting them together, but usually you have some idea of what it's related to. You then check to see, using a few other sequences from where you expect it to be, to see whether it fits in there. To be sure, you might want to fit it into the whole tree. I'm sorry? Well, what appears in a given branch is a sequence of bases that you don't find in other branches. And that sequence of bases, remember that the genetic material we're looking at here, these sequences that the tree is based on are a couple of 3,000 bases long. So there's a lot of information there. It's not as if you were looking at one little tiny part of the molecule and building the tree from just a few bases. If you did that, you probably wouldn't get anything. It'd just be garbage. But since you've got a couple of 3,000 bases, you can say that there are sequences in that sequence of bases that really are unique to some portion of the tree. And you don't find such a sequence anywhere else. And given that, remember the great thing about the sequencing of DNA is that you get all this stuff, you get all this information that you can use. It's so much better than the old days. For example, if you had to depend, if you go back to the time of Darwin and his contemporaries, and they'd be presented with a number of bacteria, which they could just barely see under the microscope. They'd have to stain them and things like that. They'd have round bacteria and rod-shaped bacteria and so on, right? To try to put those into some kind of an evolutionary tree was virtually impossible. Because it turns out that there are round and rod-shaped bacteria all over this part of the tree. So with that small amount of information from the appearance of the organisms, you couldn't do much, and you'd probably be led astray a lot too. The exciting thing about DNA sequences is that you're much less likely to be led astray simply because there is so much information in the DNA sequence. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So what is this tree about? So the sum of genes, according to one,
yes. You're quite right. If you take another piece of DNA from these organisms, it happens that we know most about this particular part of these genes, so you know this is the best tree that we've currently got. But you're quite right, if you take another gene from some of these organisms, sequence that and build a tree out of it, you can sometimes find that the branches do swap about. You may, for example, find even that the root of the tree might, say, move over here, or might even move over here. And you may find organisms that really do sort of... You never find organisms swapping... you will occasionally find organisms down at the base here swapping between the three great domains of life, simply because there has been a lot of genetic exchange between different organisms. So in order to build a tree that is consistent, you want to look for something that doesn't evolve too quickly, of course, and you want to try then to look at other groups of genes that don't evolve too quickly and build various trees and look to see if you can figure out what's going on. At the moment, this region of the whole thing is very confusing because there was a lot more swapping of genes then, it seems, especially than there is out here, although there's an awful lot of swapping of genes that happens out here as well. So you're quite right. The consistency of this tree is not as clear as the picture that I've just presented to you. There is absolutely no doubt, however, that these three great domains of life really exist. Okay? That's clear, because that happens over and over again as you build different trees with different genes. So you can be confident the three domains exist. The exact details of the branching here and so on remain to be worked out, and it looks as if maybe different genes do hop even from one domain to another. There are, for example, some archaea, some deep sea archaea that have been found to have borrowed large numbers of genes from eubacteria, so they've essentially popped over that way. Parts of them have. Yes? In addition to the ones I mentioned, okay, you have to assume, if you've got a bunch of these sequences, you have to assume, first of all, you have to line them up, and sometimes that's hard to do because the sequences have insertions and deletions in them which make them of different length. You've done all that. Okay, so you've done all that, and you've got them as lined up as you can manage. Another assumption that you have to make, of course, is that the relationship between these sequences is one that is based on common ancestry. That is to say, there really was some original common ancestry. By a sequence of small steps, you then end up with all these things. That common ancestry, it's something, as I say, that seems quite plain from the fact that these genes do all resemble each other across the tree, okay? But it's quite possible, especially for some genes, that you don't see any signs of common ancestry. If you pick a certain gene and sequence it from what you think is the same gene anyway, from various organisms, you may discover that these genes are so different from each other that there's no way of building any, that you just can't make yourself build a tree. The assumption that is made when you build these trees is that the degree of resemblance between the sequences is great enough that you can be reasonably confident that there was a common ancestry. Sometimes that's not true. For example, you can go and pick a sequence from a human and search all of the database, the whole database in GenBank, for genes that resemble that sequence and find nothing. You don't find a darn thing. You don't nothing that seems to resemble it beyond what you'd expect by chance. Okay, so essentially you look to see, compare two sequences and then scramble the sequences and see whether the scrambled sequences match any worse than the two original sequences, and do it over and over again. And you find that the two original sequences are just like the scrambled sequences, and you don't see any resemblance at all between them, if you follow what I'm driving at. Okay, given that, you can say, here's a piece of DNA that seems to come from nowhere. And there are a lot of genes in a lot of organisms that do seem to have come from nowhere. Genes, something on the order of 10 or 15% of the genes in eukaryotes are found, in higher eukaryotes like us, are found nowhere else. And it's even higher with some bacteria. You can have 25 or 30% of the genes in some bacteria that simply don't seem to resemble anything anywhere else. That's a real puzzle. And those genes, of course, are genes it's impossible to build. Excuse me. Impossible to build trees from. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I have to try again. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. You could certainly do a similar tree if you were, say, looking at words where that obviously had something related to each other. If you ask, you know, does... if you compare the two sentences, if you didn't know what the words meant, oh, absolutely, yes, you could do it, because the rules that are used here essentially are rules that allow you to say something about, if not the probabilities the two sequences are, resemble each other, nonetheless, rules that allow you to say something about the robustness of the tree that you get. One approach, essentially, to testing whether or not the tree is a robust one is to do a process called bootstrapping, which you're familiar with. And with bootstrapping, what you essentially do is take your original set of data and sort of fuzz it up a little bit. You extract a subset of that data and sort of fill up a new data set with that subset. So you throw away some sequences some sites on the sequences, and you and you represent other sites more often, certain bases more often in respect than in the original data set. And then you look to see whether the tree you build up with the fuzzed up data set looks like this tree. Okay? And you do it again and you do it again. And you find, for example, let's say that this branch is always in this position of the tree 100% of the time when you do bootstrapping. Now that doesn't tell you about the probability that this tree is real. What it does tell you is that at least this feature of the tree is pretty robust because you get it 100% of the time. You dirty up the data and you get it 100% of the time. You can make the data even more dirty by doing a thing called a jackknife where you throw away half the data and see what you get. And if you do that and you still get this branch 100% of the time, then you say, gosh, it looks to me as if maybe that branch is real. You know, maybe that branch is really there. The problem with phylogenies, for the most part, is that they, since you've only got one set of data usually, it's not possible to build a tree, you know, with other using other data sets. But as time goes on, they are building up more data sets. We can ask by using some of the genes from other biochemical pathways, what kind of a tree do we get? Does it look sort of like this tree? The answer is yes, it does, except for some details, which are probably due to things like gene transfer. So the image that you finally get as you look at this thing is that it really looks as if there was a common ancestor and that there are these three great domains of life. The details, the fact that these domains pass genetic information back and forth between each other, the kind of things that we know are happening at the present time, startling things. All these things emerge from the data set. For example, here are two sequences from chloroplasts and from mitochondria that are found in the eubacterial data set. We know that chloroplasts and mitochondria are structures that are inside eukaryotic cells. Plants have chloroplasts, of course, that's what they photosynthesize with. They also have mitochondria. Animals only have mitochondria, although there are some animals that can pick up chloroplasts sometimes and sort of pick up creatures that have chloroplasts in them. Nonetheless, most animals don't photosynthesize. Plants do. The photosynthetic process and the ability to breathe oxygen, which is what mitochondria do for you, the ability to get energy using an aerobic process that essentially allows you to use up oxygen and get a lot of energy in the process. These two capabilities are capabilities that were originally invented by the eubacteria. Way back here, probably, in the oldest part of the tree. Electron transport evolved once. Several different steps of photosynthesis involving different kinds of photosynthesis evolved back here. These little green arrows that you can barely make out. These are all things that happened in this really, really important branch of this tree. The eubacteria are really clever. These are the organisms that really did the most important stuff in terms of evolution. The result then of all this is that these bacteria were available to primitive eukaryotes, probably back here somewhere, it turns out, probably after the after Giardia, certainly it seems, because the mitochondria, which are essentially the descendants of these bacteria, entered eukaryotic cells around here, and the chloroplasts probably entered the eukaryotic cells around here. All that becomes apparent from the tree. People had suspected it for a long time, but the tree shows quite clearly that these really important capabilities evolved back here in the eubacterial lineage and then were transferred into this lineage. So that essentially, and that's what we know from a lot about the biochemistry and so on, so that fits quite nicely. If we'd found, let's say, that these sequences had mapped somewhere else, down here somewhere or something like that, then that wouldn't agree with what we know from all the biochemistry. And that would really be startling. Interestingly, the relationships that you pick up in this tree are the kinds of relationships that you expect from comparing biochemistries, from, in this part of the tree at least, from comparing the morphologies of organisms. There are no giant surprises here. There are small surprises, but no big surprises in this tree. Does that help a little? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Wow, we're talking a lot about this tree. But I think it's a very exciting thing. This tree, as I say, was something that that evolutionary biology could really begin to move on now, because we could begin to see how all these different organisms related to each other. And, you know, if people want to go into more details on how the thing was built, I guess maybe it makes sense to talk about that after the thing, because we've got a million other things we could talk about.
This is just an introduction. We'll have 3 weeks to go into.
So that kind of stuff. All right, fine, terrific. Okay, good. So, but you can see what you can do with this. You can see some of the problems. I mean, there's no doubt whatsoever that phylogenetics, the building of phylogenetic trees, is something which is extremely contentious. Many people have spent all their lives bitterly arguing with other people about how to do it. And the screaming and carrying on can be heard from one end of the scientific community to the other. Nonetheless, the more data you build up, the clearer the picture becomes. It's not as if you were... You know, the problem with a lot of these tree buildings was that people started with a rather small amount of data, and they ended up with very ambiguous trees. But as you add more and more data to your database, then you discover that different tree building methods give you very similar results and things like that. So it really looks as if this is the real McCoy. Okay? Terrific. Okay. Well, all right. Not much time, do we? All right. Let me try the second transparency here. I'd like to talk a little bit about mutations, because I think mutations are a rather neglected subject in evolutionary biology, and it's something that I suspect as sort of reductionists yourselves, you know, you'd like to reduce things to simple quantities, you'd like to know what's happening at the basis of things. That's why you're a physicist. The question of where genetic variation comes from, that on which evolution acts, is, I think, really very important. And in fact, I spend a fair amount of time in this burgeoning textbook talking about mutations. I've probably run on altogether too long about it. But the consequences of mutation, I think, are just as important as the consequences of natural selection, which we've all heard about and which we, you know, we assume is the primary force in evolution. Well, in fact, mutation and natural selection couldn't do a thing for you if you didn't have mutations, right? Because if there were no change in the genetic material from one generation to the next, then there would be no genetic variability on which natural selection could act. It might be some to begin with, but you quickly run out of that variability and all of evolution would come to a stop. So you really need mutations of a great variety of different types. And I'll try to give you some idea in the next little bit of the kinds of mutations that you might see in populations and the kinds of things that happen in the course of the changes that brought about, say, the thing that we saw in the last transparency, the radiation of different of different ribosomal RNA genes in different organisms. I think it's a kind of a general feeling that everybody's got, I think perhaps especially people in the physical sciences, that mutations are caused by radiation. Right? Hands up those of you who think that's the case. Okay. Mutations are caused by radiation. It's true. Some mutations are caused by radiation. But not all mutations are caused by radiation. In fact, it's rather striking that radiation is an influence in our environment that we can do a lot about. If our genes are damaged by radiation, we can repair them to a great extent. There are other kinds of mutations that we're unable to repair, however, and some of these are caused by accidents of synthesis, so that the enzymes that are duplicating the DNA may make a mistake. There are mutations that result from the insertion of information into our genes, from viruses and transposable elements of various kinds. You can't undo that, you're sort of stuck with it, you know, there is no repair system, essentially, for undoing that kind of thing. There are mutations that result from an increase in chromosome number or a decrease in chromosome number, the numbers of chromosomes that you have. Once that happens, there's nothing you can do about it. Many of these things are caused by environmental chemicals. They're caused by mistakes that the enzymes make as they replicate the DNA. They're caused by mistakes in the repair process, because the repair process may not be perfect. All these different things essentially will introduce mutations. It's astonishing to see how some organisms are capable of warding off the deleterious effects of radiation. We've got here a little piece of DNA, the chromosome essentially, the major chromosome, from an organism called Deinococcus radiodurans, which, as its name implies, it is a pretty durable organism. You can radiate the hell out of this organism. In fact, you can radiate this organism with doses of the radiation that would kill us all 1,000 times over. Okay? And this organism, not only does it survive, you don't even get any mortality. If you've got a million of these cells and you irradiate them with enough DNA, enough radiation to kill us 1,000 times over, all of the organisms, all of these million cells will survive. Okay? How do they do it? They do it by means that are, at the moment, not totally understood. But we can get some idea of the astonishing capabilities of this organism by looking at its chromosome. This is an electrophoretic gel. Many of you probably are familiar with these things. You can essentially separate out pieces of DNA, in this case, according to their size. Okay? And in this case, you're going all the way from... funny looking, but anyway, essentially, you've got big pieces of DNA up here and all the way down to small pieces of DNA here. This is just a ladder that shows different sizes, the standardized sizes of pieces of DNA, so that you can use that as a yardstick, essentially, for the DNA. Here, in this first lane, you've got the chromosome of Deinococcus, which doesn't show up very well because of the way it was stained, but there's just one big piece of DNA here. Now, you irradiate the hell out of this thing. You take these Deinococcus and you irradiate them and you smash the DNA into these tiny fragments. Nothing is left of the original chromosome. Everything has been smeared out. You've destroyed this chromosome, right? You've just done terrible, terrible things to this chromosome. Let them sit for an hour, or 3 hours, I would say. It puts its DNA back together again. And you go on for 6 to 9 hours and so on. Essentially, what has happened is the Deinococcus has reassembled its chromosome. Not only that, but every one of the cells that has been irradiated can do this. Every one of the cells can put together, even the ones that just have their chromosome smashed into little tiny bits, can put them back together again. You might ask, how on earth can it pull this off? It pulls this off because it has several copies of its chromosomes, and there's going to have to be an undamaged piece of one of these copies somewhere in this collection of fragments in order for it to be able to use this undamaged piece as a template to make a new chromosome and put the chromosome back together again, or assemble essentially pieces of the chromosome. Exactly how it knows that these pieces are undamaged, exactly how it knows to put these pieces together in the right order, we simply have no idea. We don't know how it does that at all. Why doesn't the copy get destroyed? Oh, you've stopped radiating. Okay. They're now sitting there. They're recovering from the radiation. And they're now going to say, all right, I've got to make another copy of myself. I have to put this chromosome back, make a copy of this chromosome, so in the next generation, my daughter cells will have a copy of the chromosome. You'd think, wouldn't you, they'd live in some place where they got radiated all the time. That's what you'd think. In fact, Deinococcus is just a soil bacterium. It's not a particularly common one. It was found originally because back in the 1950s they did experiments irradiating meat, and they irradiated the hell out of this meat trying to sterilize, and found to their horror there was this nasty pink bacterium that kept growing on the meat even after they had irradiated it. The bacterium, it turned out, was this creature Deinococcus. And you might think, good heavens, where did it normally live in the soil if it got this much radiation? Because at no point, I think, in the history of the Earth for the last 3.8 billion years, at no point has there ever been a level of radiation as high as this. Deinococcus has never, in its ordinary history, you know, its whole however many billion years it's been around, its ancestors have been around, have never met up with anything like this. How did this capability evolve? We don't have this capability. We can undo a fair amount of genetic damage to our chromosome. We're pretty good at it. We're better than mice, for example. Give humans and mice the same amount of radiation. Mice suffer genetic damage. Humans seem to be able to fix it. And that was quite clearly demonstrated with studies that were done on the people who were irradiated during the Hiroshima and Nagasaki explosions. But people, their children that were born after the, or conceived after the explosions, those children seem to have no detectable problems, any more than no more problems than you see with a control group. But if you do the same thing to mice and give them what you figure to be the same amount of radiation, all kinds of problems appear in their progeny. So that mice are far less good at fixing radiation damage than humans are. The unnerving thing about Deinococcus is that not only can you put its chromosomes back together again like this, but there are no mutations at the end of it. You can look at the Deinococcus results and you find that its genes are all just fine. There are no mutant genes in this population of Deinococcus, no more than you'd expect, you know, just by other means. Why does it do it? Well, it turns out that Deinococcus is very resistant to drying, to desiccation. Deinococcus is an organism you can dry right down. And it also turns out that desiccation damages DNA just the way radiation does. It breaks it up into small fragments. It causes, for a variety of reasons, various chemical alterations in the DNA that can cause tremendous amount of fragmentation. So desiccation acts very much like, it's not exactly the same, but very much like radiation in terms of what it does. So you can make a Deinococcus that is no longer resistant to drying. You select a Deinococcus that cannot survive being dried down, okay? A Deinococcus that can't survive desiccation. And then you ask, what happens to its capability to put the chromosome back together again? And the answer is, it's nowhere near as good as it was. It cannot survive radiation now. It can't survive drying, and it also can't survive the levels of radiation that it used to. So it looks as if Deinococcus and its remote relatives evolved this astounding ability to fix their chromosomes because, not of radiation, but because of drying, because of desiccation. So the point I wanted to make with this, really, is that radiation is only one of a great variety of different ways in which the genetic material can be damaged. And it may not be the most important one from the standpoint of evolution, because there are lots and lots of other things that happen to genes in the course of evolution that are not necessarily the result of radiation. It's been supposed, for example, that bursts of evolutionary activity in the history of the planet could be traced to nearby supernovas exploding. You've all heard these theories. A supernova blows up somewhere near the sun, bathes the sun in radiation, and all of a sudden, mammals radiate in all directions, or the dinosaurs are driven extinct, or something like that. Any number of things, essentially, it is thought could be traced to the Earth being bathed by radiation from elsewhere. In fact, it turns out that big bursts of evolutionary activity, as we'll see a little later, assuming we get to it, but big bursts of evolutionary activity that we see in the course of the history of the planet, these big bursts of activity are not traceable to sudden influxes of radiation from outside. They're traceable to things like mass extinctions, which then open up a lot of ecological niches which organisms can then radiate into. If you've got an ecological niche, some organism will move in. What's that old slogan about, if you build it, they will come, right? Essentially, if you've got a niche, essentially, organisms will then move into that niche and be able to fill it pretty quick. And that, essentially, is what happened, for example, when the dinosaurs went extinct, and all of a sudden the oceans were empty of large living organisms. It was no more than about 5 million years before whale-like organisms were populating the ocean. It didn't take too long to evolve whales. All the flying organisms seemed to have vanished, except for the birds, that some of the birds made it through. Niches opened up for nocturnal flying organisms. Within a matter of 3 or 4 million years after the dinosaur extinction, you had bats. It didn't take very long, essentially, to evolve bats. At least in evolutionary terms, it didn't take too long. That happens primarily not because of bursts of radiation, but because mutations are happening all the time from many different sources. And most of these mutations, most of the time, are bad news. But given that there are new evolutionary opportunities, some of these mutations are now going to be selected for. They will spread through populations, change these populations, sometimes very quickly, so that they can quickly adapt to new ecological niches. And we'll see lots of examples of that as we proceed. So don't assume, as I think many people do, that it is radiation that does it all. It's radiation is only a rather small part of it. Now, let's see, what can I talk about next? Let's see about that. Let me just show you this simple-minded computer simulation to get some idea of the kinds of things that happen once mutations appear in populations. A mutation will appear in a population right here in this room. Mutations are happening in various of your body cells even as we sit here, okay? During this lecture, probably thousands of mutations have happened in your various body cells. Unnerving to think of. You've got to stop. You've got to stop this, right? No, you can't stop it because it's going on all the time. Of course, most of these mutations happen in body cells that are not going to be passed on to the next generation, because most of our cells don't get passed on to the next generation. Females will donate a few egg cells to the next generation. Males will donate a few sperm to the next generation. Maybe only one or two these days, essentially the reduction in family size that we've seen over the last few decades. So not many of our cells get passed on to the next generation. Most of them don't, but they too, of course, are just as subject to mutations as the cells that are passed on to the next generation. The body cells, the somatic cells, so-called, that have these mutations, of course, unpleasant things can happen. They can become cancerous and so on. But some of them, you know, just sit there and they just accumulate damage. And then finally, when you die, they die too. It's grim to realize this, but when you do die, billions of your body cells die simultaneously, taking with them all kinds of genetic damage. Very, very small numbers of mutations make it through to the next generation. Of those that do, the ones that do essentially may be lost again. Suppose, for example, somewhere in one of your cells that is going to be passed on to the next generation, a terrific mutation arises, something that's really going to make your children very fit, a mutation for getting into MIT, let's say. Okay, so this MIT mutation is then passed on to one of your children. This lucky child gets the MIT gene. But that child dies in infancy. That's the end of the MIT gene. Okay? It doesn't get any further. Or the child could grow up, go to MIT, because that's all that has the gene for it, and its children get run over by a bus. And that then, again, a generation later, takes care of the MIT gene. It doesn't get passed on to the next generation. If you're a new mutation, you really are treading a narrow and dangerous path for the first few generations after you arrive, even if you're very advantageous, okay? And it's worth remembering that, because you can essentially plot out such a sequence of events as I've done here. These are generations starting in generation one up to generation, I think, 1,000, am I right on that? Let me just move this, yes, generation 1,000. And what I've done here is simply simulate a population of organisms, could be human beings, into which mutations are being introduced. Some of these mutations are neutral, they have no effect on the organism. And these neutral mutations I've popped in at a rate 10 times as high as advantageous mutations. So I've put in 10 times as many neutral mutations as advantageous mutations, on the theory that neutral mutations are probably fairly common. Neutral mutations, in fact, happen all the time in genes. Could give you an example of that in a moment. Okay? Damaging like this must be a Harvard man who's talking. Oh no, I didn't put any damaging ones in because the damaging ones in fact act like the neutral ones only more so. They hardly get anywhere. Okay? So if this is the total number of genes in the population, which in this case is the size of 1,000, so there are 2,000 genes of this locus in the population, then what you find is that you do begin to see a few neutral mutations that do drift up a little bit. They're constantly, of course, being buffeted by chance from one generation to the next, that do manage to achieve modest frequencies before you get to the end here, but nothing that goes all the way. At least in this particular simulation, nothing goes all the way. Advantageous mutations, like the MIT gene, are mutations that I've introduced all the way through here. These little blue marks show where advantageous mutations arose during the simulation. Most of the advantageous ones got lost too, just like that MIT gene did. Every once in a while, though, you get one that survives those first few generations and zoom, off it goes. Because I've put a real advantage on this gene. I've put a 20% advantage on this gene. So it's really got a huge impact on the fitness of the organisms itself. These genes, actually, so this is a 10% advantage. These genes are advantageous genes with a 20% advantage, and you get some more genes getting taking over the population if you put a bigger advantage on those genes. And you can see that quite a lot of these genes arose too, but most of them got lost. So even an extremely useful gene can be lost, and only occasionally will it get past those few first few dangerous generations and get to the point where it'll take off like crazy. And it does indeed take off pretty fast. It doesn't take very many generations before you've essentially replaced the old allele with the new one, replaced the old form of the gene with the new one throughout the entire population. Okay? Why are there more over here than over here? That's right. This the old allele now was replaced by another new good allele that zoomed up, and another one that followed right after and zoomed up. So you've got alleles that are replacing other alleles here in this simulation. That's right, exactly. Yeah. They are in fact different alleles that arise at different times. Okay, good point. Okay, everyone with me on that? Good. So what I'm really trying to say here is that it's a pretty big deal to replace one allele with another, even if that allele is extremely advantageous. The chances of it happening are small. Nonetheless, they're not inconsiderable. If you look, for example, at use this picture here. I must apologize, actually, for the way that all these numbers came out wiggly here. It's because of the printer that did something unexpected as I was printing it out. my printer, of course, is obviously sensitive to radiation. You're right. What we've got here, essentially, is a look at a very important gene in the human genome, the gene that codes for a protein that's part of our hemoglobin molecule, the beta chain of the hemoglobin molecule. As you probably know, hemoglobin comes in four different subunits, so to speak. Hemoglobin comes in two subunits of one type and two subunits of the other, and the four subunits work together in a very clever way so that the hemoglobin molecule is very good at carrying oxygen to remote parts of the body without dropping it too soon, and picking up oxygen on the way back from those remote places, and picking up CO2 and various other things on those remote places, and when it gets to the lungs, it usually waits a little while before it picks up the new oxygen, so it doesn't, essentially all the lungs get involved in the process of transferring oxygen to the hemoglobin. It's a hysteresis process, really, to put it in physics terms. Okay, this subunit of hemoglobin is subject to very many different mutational changes. What I've listed here are some of the mutations that have been found at the various sites in the hemoglobin molecule. This particular subunit has 147 amino acids, coded by three times that many bases in the DNA. And 460 bases in the DNA. And at many of the different sites, you can see you've got the original amino acid, and that original amino acid in different mutants found in different human populations has been replaced by other amino acids. Well, several things are apparent from this. First of all, it looks as if some of these sites don't ever mutate. That can't be true. I mean, they must mutate sometime. It might be that they are asymptomatic when they mutate, and nobody's bothered to look for them because the people running around with these mutations are perfectly fine. Most of these mutations are associated with some kind of an illness, and that's why they've been picked up. So there are probably some sites here that people simply haven't yet discovered. There are some sites maybe they don't mutate. The rate of mutation in different sites can change, can be variable. From one site to another, the rate of mutation can be substantial. So you might have some sites that have quite a high rate of mutation. Notice this position one up there, there's a bunch of different mutations that have happened there. but that probably got due to other reasons. And then you have position 47 here, where nothing seems to have happened. The spectrum of mutations that you get in the hemoglobin gene is skewed towards mutations that have a large effect, because many of these mutations are the result will cause different diseases. One of the most famous of these, of course, is sickle cell anemia, which is caused in this particular case by a substitution of a valine for a glutamic acid at position 7, and you now count to position 6 in the molecule. Sickle cell anemia we all know about because we've read a lot about it. It's a disease that is found primarily in African populations, but it's also found in southern Europe. It's also been found in the Middle East, and occasional cases of sickle cell anemia have turned up in other parts of the world as well. So it's not just confined to African populations. As you know, the gene causes a very severe disease if somebody's unlucky enough to be homozygous for the mutation, that is to say, to have two doses of the gene. I'm throwing a lot of stuff at you. Tell me if I'm losing everybody. You're all nodding your heads, you're okay? Good. If you have two doses of the gene, one from your mother, one from your father, then you'll get this nasty disease, which, until a few years ago, was essentially fatal. Fatal quite early in life. There are ways of ameliorating the symptoms of the disease now, but nonetheless, it's pretty bad news if you're homozygous for sickle cell anemia. Heterozygotes for sickle cell anemia, those who have one normal gene and one mutant gene, are protected against the severe circumstances, the severe effects of malaria. Everyone knows that part of the story. People are nodding their heads. It's not that they don't get malaria, it's just that they don't suffer from it as much as people who have the normal gene. So the heterozygotes are protected. And as a consequence, the sickle cell gene can build up in the population, because if the heterozygotes are surviving more than either the normal homozygotes or the mutant homozygotes, then if both the normal and the mutant homozygotes all died, you'd end up with nothing but heterozygotes, and you'd have 50% of the sickle cell gene. The next generation, though, you'd have a whole bunch more homozygotes turning up because of genetics. And so you'd end up with a huge genetic burden on the population. There are some West African tribes where the sickle cell gene has in fact reached 40% in the population. Unbelievable but true. The amount of malaria in that environment was so tremendous, so strong, the malaria was so prevalent that essentially these populations were caught between a rock and a hard place, essentially. They were dying because of sickle cell anemia, and they were also dying because of malaria. And the heterozygotes probably died for a lot of reasons too, but nonetheless they survived more than either of the homozygotes. So more of them survived. Sickle cell mutation is pretty rare, isn't it? I mean, you take the glutamic acid, you turn it into a valine at that particular site. You know there are 20 amino acids found in proteins, so theoretically this glutamic acid could be substituted by any one of 19 other amino acids, of which so far at least we've only found two, both of which cause a disease. The other 17 amino acids have not yet been found in human populations. So you'd think, wouldn't you then, that the sickle cell gene would not be a very common thing. It might only have arisen once in the human species, if it's such an unusual thing to happen. I'm now going to sort of backtrack a little bit here and disturb your reasoning a little bit, because I just said that mutations, the chance that mutations survive is rather small. And yet it turns out that every generation in the human species, as it's currently constituted, we're 6 billion strong now, with a lot of people, every generation, probably as many as 100 new sickle cell mutations arise somewhere in the human species. Many of those get lost. A few of them, many of them get lost by chance, many of them get lost because of their harmful effects. A few of them will appear in places where there's already malaria. And if that happens, then the sickle cell mutation can begin to build up in numbers, and you begin to see more and more sickle cell homozygotes appearing in the population. Now that kind of dynamic doesn't seem reasonable, does it? When you think of the rarity of a particular kind of mutation. But you've got to multiply that very rare event with a very large number of people and ask how many mutations are going to happen given that very large number of people. And because incautiously we have had so many babies that were now 6 billion strong, not very smart of us really, because of that, in the human population of the present time, all sorts of rare mutations are happening simply because there are so many of us. That you know, it's like people winning the lottery. Somebody has to win the lottery. Essentially, somebody might get a mutation that's of a particular type, even though the chances of winning the lottery are extremely small, even though the chances of getting the mutation are very small. Nonetheless, this can happen, and it can happen more than once. So I just wanted to give you an idea of the dynamics of these things. Mutations are rare, most of them get lost, but because there are so many organisms and there's so much DNA and there's so much going on from one generation to the next, there are a lot of mutations, a lot of new mutations that do appear in populations all the time. So mutations can be a very important source of evolutionary change. Remember then that even these rare events essentially can essentially have substantial consequences for the population. Have I sort of exhausted everybody at this point? How are we doing on time here? Do we need a break? What happened? I can go on for a while. People are all right? Okay. Any questions at this point? Have I bewildered you with a lot of stuff? No? People are either stunned or they're running out of blood sugar or something's happening here. But okay, let's go on a bit further. What other kinds of mutations can happen in the course of evolution? Well, it's useful, I think, to look at the hemoglobin genes in this regard. What I've done here, essentially, is to chart out the evolutionary history of the hemoglobin genes and an allied gene which makes another kind of molecule called myoglobin. I mentioned that the hemoglobin genes are very important from the standpoint of transferring oxygen from one part of the body to the other. We absolutely depend on them. Of course, it's the hemoglobin that gives our blood its red color. Those of you who suffered from anemia at one time or other know that it's not a good thing because essentially you need all that hemoglobin to keep yourself healthy. So you do need a lot of hemoglobin. It's a really, really important molecule. And unsurprisingly, it's undergone a great deal of evolution in the course of its history. If we go back, before the Cambrian, that is to say, before about 540 million years ago, to the pre-Cambrian, when there were no large multicellular organisms to leave substantial fossils in the fossil record, back at that time, there was an ancestral globin gene which underwent a series of gene duplications. You can think of these gene duplications in a way as mutations because they are changes in the genetic material. A duplicated gene means that you've now got two genes for the price of one. Sort of like Bill and Hillary Clinton, right? You've got essentially two genes that can do, as time goes on, perhaps different tasks. The genes can begin to diverge because they begin to accumulate further mutations. So you've got the original duplication that's made two copies, and then these genes begin to accumulate further mutations, and those further mutations may mean that the genes begin to take up slightly different properties, to acquire slightly different properties as they continue to diverge. Gene duplication is a really important process in evolution. If you look, for example, at bacteria. Bacteria might have as few as, between 1,500 and 2,000 genes. You have bacteria, in fact, that have fewer genes than that. But free-living bacteria that can get along all by themselves, can have a minimum of probably on the order of 1,000, 1,500 genes, something like that. We have something on the order of 70,000 genes, and the number keeps changing. I've heard numbers that range all the way. We're finishing up the Human Genome Project now, and everyone's arguing about how many genes there really are, and they keep coming up with different numbers. I think it'll probably stabilize somewhere around 60 or 70,000 genes, so I could be wrong. We've got 60 or 70,000 genes. We have, say, 60 times as many genes as these bacteria. Now, of course, we're much more complicated than the bacteria. We can do many things that bacteria can't. Of course, the bacteria can do things that we can't as well. But nonetheless, we've got all these extra genes. And the question is, where did they come from? Did we invent new genes starting from scratch? Did we essentially begin with a piece of DNA that didn't code for anything and then gradually evolve a gene out of it? Virtually never does this happen. Almost always, new genes arrive by gene duplication. It must have been the case even at the very beginning of life when there were very, very few genes in the first organism. We don't know much about that period at all. But nonetheless, gene duplication is one of the most powerful processes in evolution. It's something that really introduces all kinds of new capabilities, because as the genes duplicate further and further, they can take up more and more different tasks. There are gene sequences, you're right, that haven't been found in any other organism. Good for you. People have been arguing about what's going on there. The feeling is that they probably have undergone so much evolution. They evolved very quickly. That's the sort of the latest feeling about it, although I don't know whether this will turn out to be true. I mean, there's one possibility is we simply haven't found these other genes yet. Another possibility is that these are genes that have undergone a lot of very rapid evolution, so fast that they now look completely different from everything else. And I think people haven't really decided what is the likely explanation for this, but there are tests, that's a testable hypothesis. You can ask, for example, looking at bacteria, do these genes evolve very quickly? You know, do they continue to evolve very, very fast? Is it possible to pick up mutation rates? It's technically rather difficult to do that, but it should be possible to design experiments to get at that question. And the answer seems to be that in genes where you can see the relationship between them, so that you can trace them back through time, those genes have arisen as a result of a series of duplication. And the hemoglobin genes are a case in point. Answer? Hemoglobin genes, no problem, exactly. They're a case in point. But you're quite right. There are other genes that don't fit into this particular paradigm, though I suspect that they will once we understand why they are so different from other organisms. We can begin to trace their history back. It is conceivable that some of these genes really are, you know, de novo, that did really, you know, that just by chance a reasonable length of reading frame appeared just by chance, and then it had some kind of a function which then was selected for. I don't know of any really good examples of that, I must confess. But it could happen. I certainly wouldn't want to rule that out. Gene duplication, however, though, to reiterate, is a tremendously powerful force in evolution, and an awful lot of the increase in our gene number seems to be the result of duplication. We now have a lot of different hemoglobin genes in our genome, far more than I've drawn out here. The ones that really function, the ones that actually have a function, the ones that actually do something in the body, are relatively small in number. There are large numbers of other hemoglobin genes that have been inserted into the genome in various places that no longer have a function. These are the so-called pseudogenes. And they've been inserted into the genome as a result of the activity of transposable elements that will stick these pseudogenes at random into the genome, and you can tell from various clues that that's what they are. There are other pseudogenes that have arisen as a result of other kinds of duplication processes, so that, for example, the pseudo-alpha genes almost certainly arose as a result of an unequal crossover at some point in the past. Pseudogenes are all over the place. They actually outnumber regular genes. In our genomes, we actually have more pseudogenes than we have regular genes, by a substantial number, two or three times as many by some estimates. Of pseudogenes rather than regular genes. All this stuff in our genome, all this lint under the bed that's accumulated in our genome, is really very difficult to understand. It's tough to see how it could possibly have happened. So far as the sequence of events is concerned, a lot of stuff happened in the course of the evolution of the hemoglobin. Just to give you an idea of all the different things that can go on to produce this variety of genes that we see here now in the beta and the alpha, the alpha cluster here and the beta cluster here of genes. there were gene duplications that probably happened early on as a result of chromosome duplications, as a result of polyploidy events, which happened very early in our ancestry. We are all of us polyploid, that is to say, we have more than two sets of chromosomes as a result of gene doubling. And there were two polyploidy events that happened fairly early on, and several other polyploidy events that have happened in different groups of animals. So polyploidy is not just confined to plants, as you may remember from your beginning biology that you took back when. The polyploidy events really have played a very important part, particularly in the early evolution of genes. So that there was an ancestor of hemoglobin genes on one chromosome, an ancestor of the myoglobin gene on another chromosome. The myoglobin gene has stayed single all this time. We have only one copy of the myoglobin gene. It's a gene that is found in muscle, red muscle particularly. If you've got a slice of steak, that steak is full of myoglobin, which the cow has sacrificed in order to allow you to chomp on myoglobin. It's what makes steak so delicious. Really. Myoglobin is a molecule that also picks up oxygen, but it doesn't have to move the oxygen around the body. Myoglobin picks oxygen up from the hemoglobin, and it's very good at robbing oxygen from the hemoglobin. So the myoglobin gene has gotten to be very good at robbing oxygen from hemoglobin. It's a single molecule. It isn't made up of four molecules like hemoglobin. So the myoglobin gene essentially is specialized now to fit in the muscles and grab oxygen from the hemoglobin, from the red blood cells that just passed. There are pseudogenes that resemble the myoglobin gene, yes. Primarily because the retroviruses and retrotransposons that have inserted a lot of these pseudogenes have picked up some myoglobin messenger RNA, processed messenger RNA, and put those into the genome as well. So there have been a couple of cases of myoglobin pseudogenes. But functional duplication of myoglobin genes hasn't happened. You only have one copy of the functional myoglobin gene. Good point, though. Okay. We've got, then, the ancestor of the hemoglobin genes. This ancestor of the hemoglobin genes landed up on two different chromosomes. Again, as a result, probably, of another chromosomal duplication. This gene went through a whole series of gene duplications that I've shown here on this chromosome to give rise to a whole cluster of the alpha genes. This gene then, you can see this arrow very well, but this one now comes down to here. This gene essentially gave rise through a series of gene duplications to the beta cluster of the hemoglobin. The alpha and the beta subunits, you remember, are what, are found in our blood. But there are other subunits that play a role in our early development. In particular, the eta subunit and the zeta subunit are subunits which are made very, very early in embryonic development, and then these genes get turned off early in embryonic development. So just briefly, they play a role. Nobody's terribly clear what these are up to. It's rather hard to study them anyway, because they're gone very early in embryonic development. The gene products disappear. Later on, you'll see other genes appearing and then disappearing. In particular, the gamma genes, the gamma subunits, are subunits which have taken up a slightly different function from the adult hemoglobin, the beta delta adult, the alpha beta adult hemoglobin. The gamma subunits produce what's called fetal hemoglobin, which is found a little later in development. The embryonic hemoglobins come and then they go. Then as you move from the embryo, which is that little tiny thing just at the beginning of development, to the fetus, which essentially corresponds to the majority of the period of development. Then you find during this period that the fetal hemoglobin is the predominant type of hemoglobin in the blood. And that hemoglobin consists of two gamma subunits, from actually these two gamma genes, and two alpha subunits from, in this particular case, these two alpha genes here. Why do we have fetal hemoglobin? Well, we have it because we have another problem. If we are a placental organism, that is to say, if we're a mammal that spends a lot of time developing in the womb, we have to rob oxygen from our mother's blood circulation. And it turns out that fetal hemoglobin is rather good at doing that. Fetal hemoglobin is rather good at robbing oxygen from the maternal circulation, and as a consequence, you can develop better, presumably, if you can do that. If you've got fetal hemoglobin and your mother has adult hemoglobin, you can grab the oxygen, essentially, in the placenta, which is where the fetal and the adult tissues come together. And that then allows you to develop better and eventually reach term probably more often than you would if you didn't have fetal hemoglobin. You might think, well, that's really very important, and therefore... Yes, you don't find fetal hemoglobin in the marsupials because they spend a much, much shorter period of time being dependent on the mother's circulation. And you don't find it at all, of course, in the egg-laying mammals, the monotremes. Okay? So you don't find any sort of an arrangement like this. The marsupials actually have other hemoglobins that, that play a role in early in development, but they don't have this fetal hemoglobin. 2 points I want to make about this. The first one is that fetal hemoglobin might seem terribly important to have, and it probably is, but interestingly enough, the difference between adult and fetal hemoglobin is not a life or death proposition. There are many people living in Africa who have a condition called hereditary persistence of fetal hemoglobin. These people never turn off their gamma hemoglobin genes, never turn on their beta hemoglobin genes, and as a consequence, throughout life, they go on making the alpha 2, gamma 2 molecule. All through their lives, they have nothing but fetal hemoglobin. So they're running around as adults, but they still have fetal hemoglobin. They do fine. They can even have babies. Women with adult persistence of fetal hemoglobin can have children and apparently have no trouble having children, so far as anyone can tell. Now, does that mean then that this difference between the gamma and the beta gene is meaningless? Why did evolution go to all this trouble to do this? You know, if it isn't a life or death matter. The answer seems to be, no, it isn't a life or death matter, but it matters a little bit. It does matter a little bit that you've got the fetal hemoglobin in the fetus and the adult hemoglobin in the adult. It's not life or death, but even if it only gave you a 1 or 2% advantage, maybe that would be enough to evolve this whole system. It's worth remembering, I think, that when you think about mutations, many people think about mutations as being lethal or super good for you and really nothing in between. But most mutations are a whole range of different things. Most mutations have a whole range of different effects, all the way from no effect at all to very slightly positive to very positive, all the way down from very slightly negative to very negative. All these different range of different possibilities is something that you find again and again happening in many, many different genes, and one of that spectrum of possibilities presumably was the duplication that produced then the gamma gene from the ancestor of the gamma gene, from the ancestor of the beta gene, and that happened about 175 million years ago during the Jurassic, and that split has eventually resulted in the has resulted essentially in organisms that are now perfectly capable of undergoing placental development, which they might not have been able to do if they didn't have that little extra push that this duplication gave them. Is the duplication unique? The answer is no. Other organisms have independently invented fetal hemoglobin. So there are other organisms that also have fetal hemoglobins as a result of duplications of their hemoglobin. Some sharks have fetal hemoglobin because some sharks are in fact capable of giving birth to live babies. They don't do it the way we do exactly. They start off with an egg, but the egg hatches inside the mother and it then turns into a baby shark, which is then born alive. And those baby sharks carry the shark equivalent of fetal hemoglobin. So they can essentially borrow oxygen then from the shark mother's circulation. We're not unique in this regard at all. Over and over again, in the course of evolution, you find that the same thing gets invented over and over. Well, people are bailing out here. Is there something happening?
Yes, it was. It's
about tea time. Ah, yes, all right. Sure, okay. Maybe I could just turn it over to questions, please. I've covered an enormous amount of stuff. Really, I've sort of given you a quick overview of a lot of different evolutionary processes and so on. If everyone says stand, they keep thinking about tea time. Yes, because when you think about it, Mother Nature is pretty lazy, if you like. If you've got a gene that already does a job and it duplicates, and so now you've got two copies of that gene, both doing the same thing.
Okay?
It won't kill you, first of all, right, that's okay. Second, now there's lots and lots of opportunity to begin to change that, sometimes quite substantially change the function of that gene without your having to go right back from scratch and invent a gene from scratch. It's far more likely that this sequence of events will happen, because it just requires a duplication and then subsequent mutation, than if you start with a piece of DNA that didn't code for anything and then end up with a gene. Generally speaking, it's not so much that evolution is lazy, I'm being unkind to the evolutionary process. It's much more that evolution takes the first thing that's offered to it. If a mutation is far, one kind of mutation is much more likely to happen than another. And almost certainly, it's that mutation that will begin to build a particular evolutionary direction. It's a probabilistic argument, really, because some kinds of changes are much more likely to happen than others. It's much more likely that you'll get a gene duplication and subsequent divergence than that you'll start with a piece of DNA that doesn't code for anything. Then you've got to put in, you know, an initiation codon and a termination codon, and you've got this piece of garbage in between that might code for a protein or... You know, it's really tough to build a gene out from scratch, but it's a hell of a lot easier if you've already got a gene to start working with, which is, you know, the point I think you were making, that there are pieces of DNA that we haven't found relatives of. But these, if they code for a gene, those genes are really terrific genes. I mean, you know, they make proteins that have all sorts of interesting properties. They've got a big evolutionary history. You know, they haven't just been invented from scratch. And in fact, interestingly, if you... as people have done, if you build a protein from a random sequence of amino acids and look to see what you end up with, you end up with a mess. You just end up with a little twisted piece of stuff that has no particular structure to it. Real proteins, I'll give you some examples of that. Yeah, I probably have something here. I'm just going ahead of my story a little bit here. It's not zero. It's very small, exactly, yes. If you look at real proteins, not zero, quite right. But you do end up, if you just build something at random, it's true, if you build random protein after random protein after random protein, maybe you get something, exactly. But the chance that you get something as complicated as this, a protein here which consists of a whole series of alpha helical sequences that essentially give you a kind of spiral staircase effect from the sequence of amino acids. A whole series of things that are called beta-pleated sheets, where hydrophobic amino acids tend to fit together and form these sheets of amino acids that run back where you have the sheet a little bit better here, where the sequences essentially run back and forth, and you can build up a kind of structure to the protein as a result of that. This stuff just doesn't happen if you put amino acids in at random. It does happen, however, if you get a molecule that's gone through literally billions of years of evolution. These molecules are chock full of information, far more information than the amino acid sequence tells you. The information is far more complex than that. And the likelihood that you could start from scratch and end up with something along these lines, well, not zero by any manner of means, it's pretty darn small. You're much more likely these days to start, you know, with a gene that has been duplicated already and go from there. In the distant past, of course, the very first genes that appeared probably made pretty lousy gene products. But because they were the only genes around, and these gene products might have had a little bit of activity of some kind, then presumably those genes survived. And the rules by which life, the evolutionary process was played at the very beginning of life, are likely to be quite different from the rules today, where you've got to be pretty damn good if you want to survive. You know, you've got a lot of other organisms that want to take your ecological niche away from you. You cannot afford to sit around and wait and build up a new gene. You've got to start with something else. So the rules have changed. That's what I think. Staying on that uncertain note.